And now we're fortunate enough to have with us today Mike Whitney, and he's part of Counterpunch's dream team of economic writers, which includes Michael Hudson, Peter Marici, and others. So, Mike, thanks very much for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Brendan.
So as I was saying before the program, we really are very fortunate to have you. You do have a devoted fan base throughout North America, throughout the United States, Canada. A lot of listeners prefer your program. It's always very interesting giving us the latest on the economic news, such as it is. I mean, you did predict large elements of this crisis long before anyone else was talking about it. And I've been trying to keep up with your articles. We're going to be talking about the Employee Free Choice Act and some of the articles you did, but there's been at least four articles in the last few weeks. So, I mean, it's been pretty hard to keep up, hasn't it?
It's virtually, you know, I used to try to follow the politics as well as the economics, and now I can only spend an hour or two on the politics per day because the economic situation is just so dire, and so much is happening every hour that it really requires a lot of research.
Yes. When you start talking about SIVs and derivatives and the many diverse elements of the mortgage crisis and then what's happening on Wall Street, it does become overwhelming. You do make it easier to understand, and we'll be able to talk about some of those things later in the program. I wanted to start out by talking about something that might be more familiar with some of our listeners, and that's union legislation, the labor legislation about unionization and joining unions, creating them. And it's something that was pitched in the United States, a new legislation that came out trying to make it easier to unionize. And this was the Employee Free Choice Act. It was a proposed legislation, and it would have made it easier to, if you're an employee who wants to create a union, you could, or to join a union that already exists, you could make your workplace do that by signing up for ballots. If you signed enough ballots, you would automatically become certified. And I noticed that seems to put the choice into the employee hands, because it means that businesses can't elect to call an election and then try to intimidate workers into voting against the union. Is that basically how it worked?
You know, you're summing it up very, very accurately. It's basically they're having a huge propaganda blitz that has been big business and the Chamber of Commerce. They've spent over $50 million on this campaign already, and basically all CARCH, as it's been abbreviated, which is the Employee Free Choice Act, is it makes it easier for people to organize a union. And right now, you know, like you said, that a majority of workers can sign up for a union, but the company can simply veto that decision and then demand an election. And before that election, they have a number of different ways where they can harass or intimidate employees. And, you know, letting them know that, of course, if the union is voted through, that they may lose their jobs, or there may be cutbacks, or they're going to have to cut staff, or blah, blah, blah. What CardCheck does, and first of all, we need to precede this by remembering that in the United States in the 1950s, 32% of workers were unionized. Now that has dwindled to 8%. So it's just a very small portion. And so the power of labor in the United States is very much diminished, and this has a huge effect on the recession we're having right now. But we'll get to that in a minute. Right as the CardCheck, as it stands right now, if they get enough people to vote or to sign cards that they want a union in their workplace, then all they have to do is pass that by the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB. And the union goes into effect, and there's nothing the employers can do to stop that. Beyond that, there's really not that much to it, except there, you know, when there are disputes about labor or benefits or wages or something to that effect, then and management and labor can't reach an agreement, then a federal mediator intervenes and can impose binding arbitration. So, I mean, at least you have an impartial outside person who can resolve the issue. But, you know, my own take on this, and it's not purely a money issue. We're talking about basically power and the power that that management does not want to share. Now, with this recent G20 meeting, we saw that there was some consensus opinion among the United States, Britain, and the rest of the G20 on certain issues about stimulus and you know, investigating a greater oversight of hedge funds, blah, blah, blah. But who was represented there? these were the finance ministers. These were the heads of state. These were the people who run the financial system, essentially. There was no one there representing labor. So the great mass of workers have no voice in government, have no voice. And the reason this is important is because the recession we're dealing with right now is the result of overcapacity in the system. It's a breakdown in the financial system. But now, because people are carrying so much debt, because they've lost so much in their 401ks, because their housing values have decreased by at least 30%, and because their job situation is so tenuous, people have stopped spending. And so we have tremendous overcapacity. Now, when you have union wages and wages that keep pace with the rate of production, then they increase incrementally. And that is the only real way to maintain demand. So don't think this is just some wild leftist labor organized idea. This is a panacea for maintaining a strong, resilient, robust economy. Wages have to be, keep pace with production. And when they don't, then the only way that the economy can grow is by expanding debt. And that's exactly what got us into this current situation.
Well, we can certainly talk about that. But just in terms of what this means for the labor force in the United States, it seems that the Employee Free Choice Act was trying to bring the United States in line with other developed countries that seem to have better labor legislation, more cooperation. I think you mentioned in your article that the business press had really attacked this legislation on multiple grounds. They were quite vicious, but one of them was that it could lead to European style social market economy, with all those things we in Canada enjoy, perhaps healthcare and things that the Europeans have that Americans don't, like real vacations. So they're trying to scare people into saying, you could be like Europe if you give labor more power.
I have to say it was one of the most incredible articles I've ever read in the Wall Street Journal, which is usually pretty good in waging war against this kind of class warfare. They're pretty skillful at it. And they've been taking aim at the Employee Free Choice Act every day, sometimes twice a day, on their op-ed page, and in the most vicious, terms imaginable. But in this particular article, they were saying that, we don't want to become Europe. And I have a quote here that says that, you don't want these generous unemployment benefits, long holidays, various job protections, and a prominent role for unions. That's a quote. Now, I'm not sure that people would be discouraged from voting for a union if they knew that they had, 5 weeks off a year with paid benefits and maternity leave and a guaranteed pension. That's not exactly a scary thought. In the United States, that would sound like workers' Valhalla. So, I think that they predicate their argument on the only good is growth. And this is why labor needs a voice, a seat at the table, because, these are a lot of quality of life issues as far as, educating your kids and, maintaining a certain standard of living. And especially poignant right now for American workers as more and more people fall from the middle class because of this downward spiral we're in.
Well, you've mentioned that this is the result of an attack that's happened over 20, 30 or more years, that Americans are scared to call for these kind of services like healthcare, real vacations as part of their job packages and so forth, because there's been this idea that you have to disempower the ordinary person and leave it all up to the banks to decide how money is circulated. And this means that people have just sat there while their real wages decrease since, the 70s, I think. The highest point at which the average American wage reached was about 1973, right? And it's been sort of downhill from there.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, wages decreased in the 8 years of the Bush administration. So we're losing ground very quickly. But what we haven't lost ground on was the ability to borrow more and more money. As a matter of fact, anyone with a pulse and who could sign a document for a $400,000 mortgage could pretty much get one. So we all know what that story is. And, the people who are in power right now, as far as the banking elites and financial mandarins, the Democrats, the supposed liberals, this is a bipartisan operation. People are jumping ship on the Democratic side already about card check, and there's so much pressure and so much money being brought to bear. You know, the Chamber of Commerce has kicked in $20 million, the Coalition for Democratic Workplace, $30 million, the Employee Freedom Action, you know, on and on and on. There's a tremendous amount of money on the other side, and of course there's some, there's considerable money coming in from the unions as well, and they're very organized, but they can't match the money that's coming in, and the media, and the politics. Frankly, I think that if it were to pass the House and the Senate, Obama would not sign it because he is surrounded by people who represent the banking establishment. Timothy Geithner, Larry Summers, and there's a Paul Volcker, and a number of people from Goldman Sachs, and basically the entire financial establishment is you know. So regardless of whether you believe Obama is a terrific guy and eventually he'll do the right thing, the advice he's getting is from a very small select group of banking elites.
Well, let's talk about this. It's come up a few times. What's wrong with the Democratic Party? Why aren't they doing more to push through the interests of what are supposed to be their constituency, which is blue-collar people, visible minorities, organized labor, and so on? This is the time to do it. This is FDR time. So what's stopping them?
Well, it's basically you have to get back to the root cause, which is the amount of money that's been able to filter into the system because of Supreme Court judgments as far as, equating the amount of money that, PACs and that individuals can put in the political system, and equating that with free speech rights, which is what essentially the ruling of the Supreme Court has been up to this point. But we can see how corrupted the system is that, some of the biggest beneficiaries of Wall Street's largesse are Barney Frank, are Chuck Schumer, are Chris Dodd. So, these people have really essentially cross-pollinated, and the idea that the Democrats represent working people's interests is basically a sham that's been allowed to continue because they seem to be a little more moderate or centrist on social ideas like gay marriage or stem cells or something like that, and they don't represent the extremism of some of the people in the Republican Party, but they're certainly not pro-labor. This country needs a labor party very desperately, and probably a party that would stay off the issues that just incite divisiveness, instead focusing on bread and butter issues that everyone has to deal with, and then we could move it further to the left in that way.
Well, bread and butter is a huge issue right now, and you've mentioned how wages haven't kept pace with inflation, real wages have gone down. Now, it's my understanding from the analysis you posted that low wages might have even helped fuel the Great Depression, make it worse, right? So, I mean, you can recover faster if wages are falling slower than prices and people are able to do things. So what kind of situation are we in right now? Because the whole world is producing now at very low wages, so that must really hurt demand.
Well, yeah, what they call labor arbitrage is basically exporting our higher-paying jobs to areas of the world, and this is a very concerted effort. Essentially, if you believe in any sort of conspiracy, I don't think it's a conspiracy. If you look at capitalism in any developed country itself, it tends towards stagnation eventually, and the reason is because output and production tends to become more and more concentrated in fewer hands. And so what happens to the surplus capital? They have to find more and more creative ways to develop that. So it goes into emerging markets, and it goes into mortgage-backed securities and all this financial crap. I mean, everyone knows, essentially, that the stuff that generates the largest profits now is essentially paper-pushing, and most of it being somewhat fraudulent. And it's creating more and more extrapolation from smaller and smaller slices of capital. So, at the other end of the spectrum is the fact that labor costs have to be constantly pushed down further and further. And so that they were going to try to keep the three auto companies going. At least this was the original intention. But they wanted to crush the union. How do we know that? Because at the same time they were negotiating for a paltry $25 billion to keep them going, they were funding GMAC's financial bureau, which was providing money for people who wanted to buy cars with no money down, et cetera, et cetera. So they never would have been working out terms for financing the finance end of GMC if they weren't counting on keeping the automakers themselves functioning. So it was all a ruse so that Paulson and the rest of the gang, and Geithner, he was part of this whole thing, could get in there and make these ridiculous, crush the union and make people who are living on very limited pensions, who had put 40 years of slave labor into the building cars, take away what modest pensions they're getting, or at least renegotiate them. This is completely unfair. And what's really tragic about it is that the government, Democrats and Republicans alike, were working hand in hand with financial elites to carry out this anti-labor war is what it is.
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned this. I'm really glad because people aren't talking about this enough, whether it's on the radio or TV in the newspapers. It was the same thing in Canada as it was in the United States. We all saw it happening. When the banks said they needed money, Obama was quick to race there and say, "Here, what do you need? $500 billion, $700 billion, a trillion, $2 trillion? We'll give it to you. Here you go. No strings attached, no questions asked until the problems with the AIG bonuses came up. So it was a throwaway to them, a giveaway to them. And when auto sector says they need money, first they hauled them over and said, why did you fly in private jets? You know, and I mean, you could make the argument that they shouldn't be showing that opulence, but the focus was on the auto sector. And then they said, if you want to get money in the auto sector, you better be prepared to make cuts. You guys are slow, you're obsolete, you're outdated, you're inefficient, you're not doing a good job, and you're uncompetitive, and you guys really got to buckle down and make changes if you're going to get a single penny from us. You've got to earn it and sweat and show us that you're going to do something. So they made them sweat, and they put everyone, you know, through a grinder, and they got the auto workers to take concessions, and they want to come back and take concessions again. So it's clear that they've been sort of hanging auto sector out to dry so that they can scare them into getting more and more concessions out of the actual workforce.
Well, first of all, when GM, its sales went down almost 50%, they were saying, well, their business model is flawed, get rid of them, they've never built the cars we want, they're junk, blah, blah, blah. Toyota, Nissan, all these other companies, their sales were down at least 35, maybe more percent at the same time. No one in Tokyo is saying, let's axe Toyota. So the unevenness of this to begin with was just absolutely absurd. But the fact that they wanted to keep one of our major industries and jobs that are accompanying that as far as furnishing parts and services could be as many as 1.5 to 2 million people connected directly to that, that we would throw a major industry like that onto the slag heap because it doesn't sell garbage mortgage-backed paper that we're providing $13 billion. Look, yesterday, or this last week, Bloomberg had an article that said that we have currently spent $12.8 trillion in commitments and loans to the financial system so far. And here we are, a paltry $25 billion, or maybe it's $50 billion to GM and the rest of the auto companies to keep all these people who depend on their livelihoods to keep this industry going. And the way that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury have gotten this money has been the most unscrupulous thing. Remember, we voted for the TARP, which was $800 billion. We voted for the stimulus, which was $800 billion, or $878 billion or something like that. That's only $1.5 trillion. So how did the rest of this money, the rest of this $13 trillion, get into the system? Well, the Fed has taken it upon itself to print all this money and use it in its lending facilities in the same way that Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, and they're planning to do these new programs, the TALF and the PPIP, another $2 trillion that they're going to create as leverage. So they're going to completely bypass the democratic process. They're going to completely sidestep the Congress and the rule, basically the spirit and the letter of the law
Well, I really share your opinion on this. I mean, in South Ontario, our economy is very strongly dependent on the auto sector and by extension also the steel sector, which produces steel for autos and other products. So it's terrifying to watch the United States prioritize the financial community that got us into this mess and ignore the industries on which so many jobs, not just in those industries, but across the sector, depend on. So, I mean, I remember there was a pension bankruptcy negotiations for Stelco, a steel company, 2004 to 2006. And, you know, the Wall Street, there are a lot of Wall Street buyers and bankers and financiers and, you know, financial gamblers trying to get a piece of the company and bondholders and saying to the steel workers, we really don't care what happens to you or your pensions. You know, we just want to get our money and get out of it, or see what we can squeeze out of your company before your pensions and benefits are all gone. And these are the kind of people that seem to be prioritized when it comes to aid and handing out money from Geithner and your government.
Yeah, but think about that for a minute. Think about the duplicity and the hypocrisy of the government that is now complaining, well, we can't take away these bonuses from AIG. Why? Because of contractual obligations that would wind us up in court. But at the same time, the contract obligation they have to some pensioner who put 40 stinking years of his life putting fenders on Buicks is getting his cut in pay for his measly, like, $600 a month pension because someone wants to rewrite it, because someone in Washington, like Paulson, Geithner, or whoever, wants to rip up the contract and start fresh. So we can what? So we can have employees that are making the same wage that they're making putting Toyotas together in Alabama where they don't have any labor rights at all. You know, this is really an outrage. And if we had any media in this country, there'd be people in the streets right now.
Yes, well, people aren't talking about that angle as well. A lot of the complaints you might hear or read when you look at the comments section on an online newspaper like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times is, well, those auto workers, they make too much money anyway. They're unskilled labor. They just bolt doors on cars. Why are they making $70 an hour, right? And, of course, they're not making $70 an hour. They're not even making close to that. And that's even if you combine their wages and their pensions and all the expenses that they make for the company, it's still not $70 an hour. But they try to push those numbers. Meanwhile, working on an auto line is very difficult. You have a high risk of heart attack, more so than an executive, from all the repetitive labor, repetitive strain, and doing the same thing over and over again, hour after hour, day after day, year after year. And these are the people that just want to retire with some kind of decent life after putting, as you said, almost slave labor into this in terms of the quality of their work. And they're among the first to get cut if Wall Street and Washington get their way on this.
Exactly. And even so, the idea that people should get benefits, you know, beyond the 40 years they put in or whatever, seems to really offend these people. The idea, they think of pensions as welfare. They think of the trade-off that laborers make in sacrificing their life to put out a good product as somehow corporate welfare, and that these things can just be revoked or repealed at some later day, which is essentially what they're trying to do. And, you know, management is always going to be like that. I really think that people think who think that the people who run these companies are like us are just making a serious mistake and that they're just being naive. What is disappointing to me is when the government hops into bed with them, because the government has different obligations. They should operate in the public interest. Now I'm probably being naive, but that is what we have to bring the government into account for and into line with, is you know, somehow fulfilling the will of the people.
Well, this reminds me of a kind of theoretical question I wanted to ask you related to the bailouts and the situation generally. And that is, I mean, it was clear they were willing to dispense trillions of dollars to bail out these bankers who failed on the market there and give them welfare. But what if they had just taken the money that they gave the bankers and put it into, number one, give it to the mortgage homeowners who could no longer afford to buy their homes, and so they no longer were in debt to the banks? And then, like, wouldn't that mean that the homeowners don't have a problem, and then the banks don't have a problem, and they don't need a bailout, and there's other stimulus that could have gone to in terms of infrastructure that would have stimulated auto and steel, right? Could that have been done?
Absolutely. But, I mean, I think you really have to look at that question and ask yourself that question, looking at it from a number of different perspectives, because that's the only way you're going to figure out what should have been done and why they won't do it. Right now, instead of providing debt relief, remember, you're talking about people who a year ago their houses were worth 30% more than they are today. Their 401ks in the retirement may have been worth 50% more than they are today. And their jobs are much more precarious situation. They don't know what the job situation is going to be going forward. So what has happened? Consumer confidence has collapsed. People in 2006, savings actually went negative. Now they're up to 5%, and people are projecting that they'll go to 10%. That means that people are, you know, physically very afraid of what's coming. And so they're not in a position where they can spend. So how do you, if you have a consumer economy where 70% of growth depends on people going to Target and just spending what they spend on food, et cetera, you have to make it so consumers can spend again. You can't just give them more easy money and more available ways to get further into debt. It won't work. So the only thing you can do is provide debt relief for these people and cut down the face value of the mortgage and what they call cram downs. That's the only thing going to work, because when you have too much debt, Brandon, think for yourself. If you have like too much debt on your credit card, you curtail your spending. Everyone does. That's the way it works. Now, what are the bankers doing? They're approaching this entirely from the wrong direction, from the opposite direction. They just spent they're going to spend $750 billion buying bad paper from Fannie and Freddie so that interest rates go down so more people can buy houses. It's not going to work. The interest rates have already gone down to historic low rates, and the rate at which the housing crisis is accelerating on the downside is increasing. So that's just not the way to fix it. These people come from an institutional bias and a class bias that makes it impossible for them to see how they can fix the problem. And there's a quote that I used in my last article from Albert Einstein that said that the minds that created the problem can't be the same people that fix them.
Indeed. I mean, let me get this straight. So they're saying that we need to make it easier for banks to lend. We've got to give them more liquidity and the ability to give credit to people that are going to be too scared to take a loan because they don't
have it. No, exactly not. What we need to do is give the courts, empower the courts to have people take their mortgages in what they call cram downs, so that the face value of the, you know, the problem is that one out of six people now is underwater on their mortgage, okay, which means that the house, say, is worth $300,000. The house is worth $300,000, and the mortgage they're paying is $400,000. So if you took that to court, then you would get a ruling, and the judge would say, okay, we're going to cut this down to $325,000 or $300,000 or something like that. There's very profound contractual problems with that, but some of the most notable economists in the country, including Nouriel Roubini and a number of others, are saying that's the only way it's going to work, because you cannot get the economy up and running again unless consumers can spend. And they can't spend with the amount of debt overhang they have. So if we're spending money, it should be in stimulus for people who are going to spend it, as far as creating jobs programs, et cetera, or debt relief.
Yes.
Not just allowing the bankers to create more debt.
Yeah, I was summarizing what I thought the government's position is, not the actual solution.
Oh, I see.
Well, I mean, you're talking about the government and their bias, and I mean, in terms of Obama and the people that created the problems, Obama's position just seems to be to talk about inspiration and rainbows and sunshine, right? So he's not changing course dramatically to meet these new realities.
I think that, you know, a lot of people, I think, who would characterize themselves on the left think that Obama will respond to pressure. And I assure you, this situation is going to get a lot worse. I read a long report from the Economist, their intelligence team, today, and they're expecting this thing. This is going to be, you know, Great Depression-type severe contraction of the economy with social unrest and disruptions in many places around the world, and they don't exclude the United States from that possibility as well. The next leg down is going to be quite severe, the next leg as far as deleveraging in the system. So, you know, Obama has to surround himself with at least some different voices. people tell me that he does read Paul Krugman. Krugman has been extremely, you know, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, has been very critical of the plans that they've put together, which are nothing more than a shell game trying to move the bad assets from one balance sheet to another balance sheet while paying them off with taxpayer money and pushing all the losses onto the taxpayer. This is a really bad plan, and it just kicks the can down the road so that the next guy has to take care of it.
So, I was just saying, it's funny that you mentioned Krugman. I believe there's a funny song on YouTube right now where some guy is actually singing, "Why isn't Paul Krugman the Treasury Secretary? Why isn't he Obama's advisor?" Have you seen that one yet?
I haven't seen that, no, but I wish he was.
Oh, I think you can find it through Counterpunch. Maybe I'll email it or provide a link later in the program. There is that funny plea to have Krugman brought in on Obama's administration. But in any case, it's almost time to go. I was just wondering, do you have a few minutes? There's a couple more questions I wanted to ask you.
That'd be great.
Okay. Well, all this talk about the Democrats and corruption and regulation and it just evokes the image of Eliot Spitzer, of course, and he's the guy that was nabbed in the prostitution scandal, if we want to remember it, by the way CNN portrayed it. And his job, of course, was to regulate Wall Street prior to this disaster. And your article has mentioned that he had been doing a fairly good job of getting involved in the nitty-gritty details of how things worked in terms of the mortgage-backed securities and what was about to crash. And I guess he had made some powerful enemies. To what degree did he see the corruption that was occurring behind the scenes?
Well, Spitzer had put together, he had been the spearheaded a plan to get the, I think he enlisted almost every other attorney general in the country when they saw in 2004 that the subprime thing was not some innocent, was a massive predatory lending scam, which he thought that this is not just a matter of coincidence or a hyperinflated market. So he wanted to do more investigation of it. And the Bush administration invoked some funky law. I can't think of it at the time, but it was an obstructionist law that prevented the attorney generals from further investigation or prosecution of the subprime issue. Now we find out today that the FBI also was doing investigating of the subprime, predatory lending scam, and found out basically the same thing and had warned Congress, and still nothing was done. So the details of this are, the fingerprints were all over this, and the White House was clearly implicated in blocking any kind of investigation into this, which tells me that they knew that there was this massive scam going on. It was basically a big money laundering operation where they were, lending money to people who had no opportunity, no possible way of ever paying it back. They either had no job or no assets or bad, bad credit history or whatever. But they didn't care because the mortgages were going to Wall Street. Wall Street was repackaging them and selling them to foreign central banks and to, investment funds and to, basically people in funds in Germany and France and whatever. So Wall Street basically, I think, partnered with the Bush administration to block any further investigation of it. And the money just kept flowing until the whole thing blew up.
Now, it's my understanding that eventually he was replaced by someone who was much lighter touch, had a much lighter touch when it came to regulating these people, someone who believed that the companies could regulate themselves and so forth. Who's in there right now? What's their position on...
Well, my argument in the article was that he should replace Mary Shapiro. And Mary Shapiro was a member of the Clinton administration, Bush senior administration, and I think she went all the way back to Reagan. But she has a long history as a regulator, but, she basically believes that markets are self-regulating, and she belonged to an industry-funded regulatory body called the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority that basically stood by while You know, Lehman Brothers blew up, and the Madoff scandal, and the mortgage meltdown. I mean, she's just basically an industry type who was twiddling her thumbs while the whole system was melting down, which is what they want. They want someone who looks like a cop, who has that sort of authority. Look what Christopher Cox did. Christopher Cox, the former head of the SEC, you know, five biggest investment bankers, led by Henry Paulson, approached Cox and said they wanted to increase the amount of leverage they used. And so, you know, Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, and all of these other banks increased their leverage to 30 to 1 to 40 to 1, and essentially the whole $4 trillion investment bank scam up in their face. And that's essentially the meltdown in Bear Stearns was the beginning of the end. That was 19 months ago, and that's when people realized that there was no money supporting all this huge balloon, that there was maybe $1 for every 30 that was borrowed.
Yes.
And that's the sort of contraction we're experiencing right now.
Yes, that seems to be consistent across the board, that disparity. Well, just it's time to go, but just for our listeners, I know it's been hard to keep up on the latest in the market, but you're among the few who have been able to really see what's happening as it happens. And I'm just wondering, how bad is the damage basically right now in terms of money loss? And how do you evaluate this recent uptick that people have been seeing over the last week or so in the market?
Yeah, it's very interesting, but if you look back in the Great Depression, there were some long periods where we had basically what you call a bear market rally, where people deceived themselves into believing that that the system is repaired. I don't think anyone believes that. We headed into this on the housing situation meltdown led us into this recession, and it will lead us out of the recession, and we're probably a little bit more than half as far as the price declines on the housing. And something to keep in mind is what was so discouraging last week about the news on housing, which is that prices had dropped 19% year over year, okay? But what was discouraging about it is that the price declines are accelerating. That's very, very important. We are going down at a sharper incline now than any time before that. So these prices are not going to settle out for quite some time, and there's nothing the government can do to patch that up. The entire privately owned mortgage market, it no longer exists. Basically, you're going through FHA or Fannie and Freddie, or you're not getting a loan anymore. So it's really a dire situation. And the uptick in unemployment is dramatic. We're going from 500,000 lost jobs a month to 650 or 7 per month. And that's a lagging indicator, so that's going to – every person that's out of a job is not buying at the same robust rate that he was before. So it's highly deflationary. No matter how much money they pump into the system right now, they can't get it into people's hands fast enough because the banking system is broke, which means that the conduit for getting money or getting credit into people's hands is no longer functioning. So it's a very serious situation. And Obama has the chance with the limited resources we have. He needs to do the right thing now, which means he needs to resolve these banks. He needs to take them into government receivership and get rid of the bad assets and start correcting this and restoring faith in the system. If he doesn't get rid of the banksters that are surrounding him and giving him bad advice, it's going to be a very rocky road for the United States.
Well, Mike, I'd like to thank you so much for following these developments. People are very afraid right now. We feel under siege by an economic crisis, but you're helping people navigate it and see what's happening. So I'd like to thank you for taking your expertise. Again, you're one of Counterpunch's dream team, and it's great to get your perspective on this so that people can really assimilate the last few weeks and prior to that of the research you've been doing. So I'd like to really thank you for coming on our program today.
Thank you very much, Brendan. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.